Remember that introduction to the first Star Wars movie a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away? It has a better ring than a few years ago in the mind of George Lucas. And George Lucas stood on the shoulders of his science fiction predecessors, including a few you might never have heard of. We'll change that today. You'll get to know a bit about Ray Palmer, a science fiction writer and editor who was responsible for major changes in the science fiction genre, really helped create it. Ray Palmer is profiled in the book The Man from Mars, Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey, now out in paperback. Its author is Fred Natus. He holds a PhD in American Studies, is a freelance journalist and author. He writes frequently about pop culture, pop religion, and science, and is our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange. Fred, welcome.
Oh, hi. Thanks to be here.
So let's start with terminology. What is a pulp, as in Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey, and why is it called that?
Okay, well, the pulp magazines were, tracing back to the early 20th century, even 1890s, they probably came out of the dime novel genre and magazines at the earlier times. But as they developed cheap paper and printing processes, they're turning out lots of magazines, mainly for male readers, I'd say, whereas the dime novels had a lot of female readers as well. But it's the same idea, cowboy stories, westerns, detective stories, crime stories, true crime stories. So, you know, the newsstands were just covered with these things and very colorful, lurid, painted covers. And science fiction was sort of a late entry in the 1920s into the whole pulp market.
As you point out, science fiction often becomes science fact. Did Ray Palmer often work along those lines, thinking in terms of like, hey, this could happen someday?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, you can almost see him as a Don Quixote who almost gets lost into the whole myth of science fiction, because really Hugo Gernsback, they named the Hugo Awards after, really was the first impresario, if you will. He came up with the magazine Amazing Stories, which was first published in 1926, and it was the first time someone said, let's just put a whole magazine, a pulp magazine in this case, out, just dedicated to science fiction. And he tried to instill this, and succeeded in instilling a great zeal in his young readers, 16-year-olds like Palmer at the time, for the idea that, you know, this is a really new genre. It wasn't just entertainment. It was education. It was predicting the future. It was, in a sense, creating the future. Gernsback, first editor, was a PhD who was a scientist and inventor and a very stodgy fellow. But they thought all the readers were going to go home and, you know, create their own little physics labs in their basements.
That was actually something Hugo Gernsback encouraged, wasn't it, to have your own laboratory?
Right, because he had all these electrical experimenter magazines and radio, home radio magazines and ham radio. So, yeah, he's very into that do-it-yourself, you know, every kid can be a Thomas Edison kind of notion. And so this is where kind of the science fiction genre, at least in America, really, you know, flourishes, with Gernsback's first attempt create this new audience, and he depended on people like Palmer who really became zealous about it to make it take off.
And one of the things about Ray Palmer and his ilk is it sounds like as readers and fans of early science fiction, which wasn't even called science fiction, we could talk about the terminology in a moment, but they helped shape the genre itself. I mean, they were very active in letting their wishes and desires be known.
Right. I mean, that was, again, Gernsback started the letters pages where he encouraged readers to write in. He published editorials where, really, it sounds like a evangelical society, you know, how you must spread this new gospel of science fiction, and we're creating the future, like you said. In fact, the motto for Amazing Stories at that time was, extravagant fiction today, cold fact tomorrow. And Gernsback prided himself on predicting a lot of, you know, later inventions and that sort of thing. So the fans were writing letters. They were getting in touch with each other. Palmer was setting up these correspondence clubs. They were trying to educate each other. They had a whole library that he developed. Palmer also developed a whole science library, to pass volumes around to people. And actually, he created the first fanzine with one of his friends. And again, it was not at all what a fanzine looks like today. It was very much a very serious effort to canvas the sciences and where, you know, the state of learning. And only slowly became more about storytelling and the adventure and kind of romance of space travel. That sort of thing.
But it's a creation of the fans themselves. I mean, they were creating basically their own magazine in response to, in this case, Amazing Stories.
Yeah, they create their own fanzines, and they would send letters in, and they'd eventually become writers. Like Palmer was 16. I think we should probably mention that he had a lot of physical handicaps. At age 7, he had been hit by a truck on the streets of Milwaukee, and was basically, his back was shattered, and he was bedridden for years on end, and almost a torture device where he had to lie face down, flat, you know, in these restraints. I mean, a kind of horrible situation for a young active boy. And so he became an avid reader, and this became, if you will, an escape for him. So.
And so, as a sickly kid, so obviously, what was he going to do when he was lying flat for essentially 4 years?
Right.
But read, and he did read a lot. So, I mean, good time of life, good time in history for him to be available to read things, because it was just that moment that science fiction. And what did Gernsback call it was taking off?
Oh, he invented the first coined the term scientifiction, and he actually would have stuck with that. And a lot of fans liked it. They even just called it STF for short for science fiction. But Gernsback lost the rights to Amazing Stories about 5 years after he started it, and he had a new magazine, and he decided to call it, let's try calling it science fiction instead, because he felt like he'd lost the rights to the term science fiction.
Scientific fiction. All right. We'll come back and talk more about the scientific fiction, and it's morphing into science fiction as we know it today with great assistant Ray Palmer, the subject of the book, The Man from Mars, Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey. Fred Natus is its author and our guest on The Exchange. We'll talk much more about Ray and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist and author Fred Natus. He is the author of a biography of Ray Palmer, the science fiction writer and editor. The book is called The Man from Mars, Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey. And it is now out in paperback. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about science fiction and its formation, its formative years. Ray Palmer really played an important part in all this. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number is 541-552-6782, and our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So Ray Palmer actually was ambulatory, was moving around by himself after his... after he basically smashed his spine early in life, but was moving around and therefore was able to walk to a newsstand. He bought the first issue of Amazing Stories, is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Wow. And so what was it that Hugo Gernsback set out to do with this?
Well, again, I mean, he had a wonderful front cover of this strange group of beings on it looked like a shipwrecked on a moon off of the Saturn. So it was eye-popping kind of. Visuals by Frank Paul, a famous science fiction illustrator. And he, again, like I say, he was trying to create a real zeal and fervor in his reader, young readers especially. He wanted to turn them into the inventors of tomorrow. And I think, you know, some scientists do credit reading science fiction for their interest in science. But I think slowly people began to realize that this is really more about, just like the other pulp magazines, more about rousing adventure tales and yarns, what began to be called space operas. Really like westerns with good guys and bad guys in outer space battling with ray guns. Ray Palmer wrote his first story at age 16, The Time Ray of Jandra, you know, and so that was kind of his entree as an author. And I think we should mention he was not only physically handicapped, but he looked like a hunchback because of this accident. So, you know, he had to brave a lot of ridicule throughout his life because he was a tiny guy. His voice was a little bit altered, I think, higher pitch because of the accidents.
He ended up under 5 feet tall, didn't he?
Oh, definitely. He says he's 4'8", but, you know, looking at the photos, that's hard to believe. He's definitely somewhere. Anyway, he was a short guy. But what everyone says is once they met him, you know, his personality just took over, and they said, this is just Ray. You know, this is not some strange guy. But that's, I think, why he might have started to call himself the Man from Mars. He always felt a bit like an outsider. And I think science fiction helped people like him feel like they had a new community. And he actually helped carve out the whole new, you know, fandom didn't really exist until the 20s. People like Ray Palmer really set it up with the fanzines, the conventions, the and becoming professional writers themselves.
So not much time apparently elapsed between him seeing the first Amazing Stories at age 16 and then he wrote The Time Ray of Jandra when?
He says he wrote it when he's 16. It wasn't published until I believe he was 19. It was published in when he's 20, in 1930, Gernsback's new magazine called Science Wonder Stories. And I thought it was a pretty fun story. But, you know, I think Palmer was never considered a great writer, more known for his being a great editor and just a sort of zany character who really knew how to promote the genre and his pet ideas, which tended to be... he's a bit of a trickster. We should mention that in 1938, when he was 28 years old, he became editor of Amazing Stories. And at that point, it was somewhat of a failing magazine, and it had been purchased by Ziff Davis in Chicago, and they hired on Palmer, who was living in Milwaukee. And he really tried to change it around. The editor had been there from the beginning before him, was continuing to write these sort of stodgy editorials trying to educate the readers about the Earth's atmosphere, you know, long technical discussions, whereas Palmer came in with these really brash editorials chit-chatting about his day and what's going on behind the scenes and saying, you know, I'm just one of the chums. And I think this was something new. It kind of broke down the wall, especially for young readers, to feel like they're insiders, the kind of thing that you see in comic book editorial columns today.
Well, I was about to say, this sounds a lot like Stan Lee at Marvel Comics, where he's just sort of inviting a back and forth with the folks who read and consume the stuff that's being published.
Yeah, I would think that Palmer was definitely a model for people like Stan Lee and how they approached their audiences and wrote those columns. Because there's a sort of blend of humor, self-deprecating, kind of wild, you know, claims, you know, kind of tongue-in-cheek. But Palmer also really liked to play pranks on the readers, and most of them enjoyed it. For example, when he took over Amazing Stories, he had a lot of writers use pseudonyms, to be kind of house names that he invented. And he would then run, you know, meet the author's pages where he'd create this whole kind of crazy biography of this writer, often it was actually himself. So he would do things like that. He was on the cover of one of his magazines as one of the mad scientists, you know. So he kind of had fun, a little more fun than maybe Gernsback would have liked when he first imagined the genre.
I should point out that The Man from Mars, your book, is illustrated, and there are pictures of some of the covers, including the mad scientist cover you just mentioned.
Right.
Which is really a fun lark. Once you get to see some of the pictures of Ray, and then you get to see Ray as the mad scientist with this woman pointing a ray gun at him, or just a regular gun, I think.
I think it's a ray gun.
We'll call it that then. But yeah, fun. I mean, this is somebody having some fun with what he did. What we need to understand, though, is how did Ray get from publishing his story that he wrote at 16 into the business? I mean, was it pretty much a straight shot for him? It sounds like there was not much of a pause.
Well, again, I think he became such an important early creator of the fan culture. For example, in 1952, there was one of the first... science fiction conventions, you know, international ones, and they named, the first one was 1939, but anyway, at this convention in 1952 or 4, they gave Gernsback the honorary title of father of science fiction, and then they gave a plaque to Ray Palmer calling him the son of science fiction. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, he was involved with a lot of really key fanzines. He was turning out pulp stories. He was involved in a group in Milwaukee called the Milwaukee Fictioneers, which had a lot of pulp writers. So he's making connections with people. And when Amazing Stories new owners, they knew nothing about science fiction. They published things like popular photography and flying magazines and more like upscale hobby magazines. So they asked around, you know, who would be a good editor, and then Palmer's name came up, and immediately. Within a few days, he took over the job.
You mentioned that Amazing Stories was a pretty sleepy magazine and was running down under Hugo Gernsback. So was it a drastic change that he made in what Amazing Stories was doing?
Well, yeah, again, it was no longer Gernsback's magazine, but the original editor that Gernsback hired had stayed with it through all the years, and he was, you know, a brilliant, sweet guy named T. O'Connor Sloan, but he was in his 80s. You know, he called himself Old Man River. Some people call him Old Fuzzball. I mean, so Palmer basically supposedly threw out all the stories that were lined up to go and turned it really into a, he aimed it at juvenile readers and more of these space operas, just goofy adventures in space. The stories like Star Wars are really, and those serials are kind of based on that approach. Which was really coming from people like Edgar Rice Burroughs, the more the romantic, you know, wild adventures in space rather than a very science fact-based, speculative kind of science fiction.
So instead of the let's go and get the uranium from the moon of Jupiter or something, it was more like let's go beat the space pirates and collect the women too.
Yeah, they might collect a little of the uranium on the moon.
So it was it ever a difficulty for Ray to pay his bills with magazine work?
Well, supposedly when he first got in Chicago, it was very rough. I mean, his childhood had been he was impoverished. At age 20, he was in a sanatorium as a pauper because tuberculosis infection had set in on his spine, and they thought he was going to die. So, I mean, he had a very impoverished childhood. His mother died when he was 12. His father was apparently a bit of a ne'er-do-well. So his first days in Chicago, he claims he was living in a sleazy boarding house on Clark Street, and et cetera, et cetera. But his days at Amazing Stories are very good. By 1950, the genre was starting to disintegrate. The audience, at least for the pulp, which is where most of the writers were turning to make their money, the pulp industry was starting to crumble by then. And that's when Palmer starts turning to other things that really create a bit of controversy. And I mentioned that he liked to stir up trouble and kind of play pranks on readers. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the most famous science fiction controversy of the 40s was Palmer championing this fellow by the name of Richard Shaver, who was an itinerant worker, wild imagination, a sort of outsider artist. He had studied art in Detroit, but a kind of working-class character who seemed to have been a paranoid schizophrenic, most likely. He'd been institutionalized for many years.
Hold on for a second. I want to remind our audience what we're talking about here. We're talking about Ray Palmer,
right?
Science fiction writer and editor profiled in the book The Man from Mars, Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey. Fred Natus wrote it. He's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join us here at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about a pivotal figure in the history of American science fiction here with Ray Palmer. And then you mentioned that he's getting into Richard Shaver, who might have been paranoid schizophrenic, but had some interesting stories anyway to relate.
Exactly, yeah. And he started as a letter writer to Ray Palmer. I should mention Isaac Asimov also started his career writing letters to Ray Palmer's Amazing Stories at age 15 or 16 and had his first story published when he was, I believe, 18 in Amazing Stories. But in any case, in the 40s, he decides to print what seemed like a crank letter from Shaver, just on a dare. Palmer liked to do things like this because everyone else in the office thought this was, just trash. Actually, threw it in the trash. But it was a letter claiming that the writer, in this case, Shaver, had discovered a universal language that interstellar beings had brought to Earth. And, he had a whole alphabet like a Rosetta Stone explaining how he could interpret any word in this new language. And Palmer was just fascinated by this character and wondering, started corresponding with him and getting these huge manuscripts from him. And realized, he was he had some, mental issues, but he was actually incredibly imaginative character, something of a genius. He had developed a whole cosmology about underground world and the Earth, and these degenerate races down there that were affecting the Earth's surface and his mental health as well. But so they started crafting all these pulp stories, and Palmer, I think, again, as a kind of a joke on the readers, possibly, began. It took about a year before he actually published them. He kept talking about how he was going to do something new. He was going to publish stories that seemed like pulp stories, but they were actually true, because Shaver believed these things were true. And he eventually gets around to it, and people liked them. I mean, they were pretty good, fun tales. And so he ran them issue after issue. This is during the wartime, so they limited how many issues there were per year. But every cover had a new Richard Shaver story with titles like Slaves of the Worms or, these lurid titles. And so it became a kind of a divisive, because he's developing new readers, and he's also, the first story is called I Remember Lemuria, which a lot of the occultists in America saw Lemuria as this sunken civilization, sort of like Atlantis. So Palmer was trying to reach out, and I think he did, and to this community of mystics and occultists, and trying to bring them into the science fiction fold. And this created a schism with people who are more of the Gernsback beliefs that it has to be about science and creating a new future, not dredging up discarded knowledge of the past.
You can certainly see then where things began to take a turn toward what we got to know as the science fiction and horror movies of the 50s, which were a mix of, you know, astronauts visiting other planets sorts of things, but also a lot of monster stuff mixed in, like the Blob and going to other planets and meeting the Bat-Rat-Spider, I remember in one of them, and, you know, Attack of the 50-Foot Woman and stuff like that. So it began to take an interesting turn, and it sounds like Ray Palmer was certainly instrumental in that.
Yeah, I think he was. The other thing that we should mention is that the flying saucer craze came around in 1947, and people were starting to get tired of the, what was called then the Shaver mystery or the Shaver controversy or Shaver hoax. And so he, just that same year, Kenneth Arnold, the pilot from Washington State, claimed to have seen a series of unidentified flying objects over Mount Rainier, flying in this, veering in and out of the mountain peaks. And this became just a huge sensation, and there were hundreds of sightings in the Northwest, the Southwest, across the U.S., other countries, and, you know, every continent, really. There were sightings just in that few months span of summer of 1947, and Palmer realized, wow, I've got something bigger on my hands than the Shaver mystery and that kind of imaginary underground race. His publishers weren't too eager to get into this. He wanted to do all Flying Saucer issue of Amazing Stories. They didn't want to, and instead him and another editor from the Flying magazine snuck off at lunchtime and started creating a new magazine they called Fate Magazine, which was going to be about tales of the, really what Palmer was starting to get interested in, this mixture of strange but true unexplained mysteries with science fiction and a kind of a pulp aesthetic. So they set up this whole new magazine called Fate Magazine, and the first issue, the cover story is about Kenneth Arnold's sightings of the UFOs. Palmer goes on to publish a whole book with Kenneth Arnold about his adventures and really puts himself at the center of this new, another kind of visionary community. I think really this was, there was what they called the contactee, some people called it the golden age of UFO religions. A lot of these new religions in America started in the 50s when these old occultists were able to fused their ideas to science fiction, and Palmer was printing a lot of these contactee tales.
Interesting. So they found kindred spirits between the science fiction folks and the occult folks.
Right. Which and I think there was actually a movement in science fiction which they called sci-fi, P-S-I-F-I, where a lot of people were comfortable with this. Sort of the old guard and the more hard science people hated it and they were really angry. I mean, they're petitioning to get Palmer dumped from his, you know, job and so on and so forth. So it created a schism, but it also created a new genre, what Palmer called a new mutation. He felt like when he first introduced the Shaver mystery, he said, you know, Gernsback's dream has come and gone. We already live in the future, you know. And he began to look for something new. So
So obviously the fans had some issues with this. A few of them did. But, I mean, what were the sales like with the Shaver stories at Amazing Stories? And did the folks upstairs at Ziff Davis have anything to say about what was going on at Amazing Stories as it transformed?
Right. Well, I think they were pleased because the circulation was jumping. You know, it was probably the best, highest circulation of any pulp science fiction magazine of the time. It wasn't the most highly regarded. That would be astounding with stories. But It was, you know, gaining readership. The problem was the magazine was starting not to resemble a science fiction magazine. There were stories about, you know, Peruvian giants and petrified fossils and underground civilizations, and so it was really becoming what Palmer later, you know, developed as Fate Magazine. It really didn't resemble a science fiction magazine too much, except for the covers and some of the illustrations.
Well, you know, we haven't talked that much about the covers for some of these things, other than the ones that Ray was involved in. But these painted covers got fairly lurid at times.
Oh yeah.
You know, the genre at the time was a scantily clad and sometimes not even clad woman, usually at the mercy of some guy with a ray gun.
Right.
Or a mad scientist, or both. And so this is how they pulled in a lot of young men readers.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to appeal to young men. I should say that science fiction was a little hesitant to get into this kind of thing. It started more with the mystery detective magazines, and there's a magazine called Spicy Detective, which had very scantily clad women on the covers being threatened by thugs. Weird Tales was very much into these kind of covers as well. They had a woman artist named Margaret Brundage who did these wonderful paintings of women whipping each other and things. No, they're very lurid and often censored. So the science fiction world kind of slowly inched its way into that, those kinds of covers. So they're a little late on the game, but it was, again, it was like the Western or detective novel translated.
A few more twists and turns to talk about in the career of Ray Palmer. Ray Palmer's amazing pulp journey, The Man from Mars, is the book by Fred Natus. And we'll come back and talk more about Ray Palmer's life with Fred. You can join us as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Fred Natus and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Fred Natus, freelance journalist and author. He writes about pop culture, pop religion, and science. They all come together in the book The Man from Mars, Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey, about Ray Palmer, who was a major figure in the formation of science fiction in America from the 1920s on. Ray Palmer's name may also seem familiar to readers of DC Comics. We'll get to that in just a bit. Join us on the Exchange with your questions and comments and tales of Ray Palmer and your own thoughts about science fiction in the 40s and 50s when Ray Palmer had his greatest influence. Phone number is here, 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. And we've been talking generally about the kinds of things that Ray Palmer wrote about and edited and the way in which he pushed his magazines and his involvement in the flying saucer craze, for example, but still missing a few key tales about him personally. I don't want to imply that anything came easily, because anybody who was essentially had his back broken in several places at age 7 doesn't have an easy life. He ended up maybe 4 feet 8 inches tall and hunched over and close to death several times. But when Ray Palmer set his mind to things, the results were pretty extraordinary, is the way you convey it in the book, Fred.
Yeah, I see him as someone, I mean, I see his story as both inspirational and perhaps cautionary, but I mean, yeah, I think he was a remarkable person. He really could have given up easily. He was a pauper, you know. He was close to death a few times, and just set his mind to becoming a pulp writer and jumped into the editing as well. So I mean, became a real force in the science fiction community. I think, you know, I think science fiction to me is probably the most important genre of fiction, because it really tried and it succeeded in imagining the future and what the implications of technology. So I see him as a kind of a remarkable figure. And he also is very funny and he had charming and very warm personality. So even though he's playing all these tricks and confidence games, that you could say, he always saying, well, I'm challenging you readers, you know, you decide, you know, I'm putting this information out there. And it's interesting, I mean, because Carl Jung ends up quoting from one of Palmer's books about one of these contactees, a fellow by the name of Orfeo Angelucci, who wrote a whole story of his, like, initiation by these space brothers, which, again, they're very optimistic tales in the 50s, you know, a very time of crisis. Jung was fascinated by the flying saucer, the rumor of flying saucers. And I think in some ways, neither Jung or Palmer was saying the flying saucers are real. They're saying they've emerged now as a kind of a psychic phenomena that people are dreaming about and writing about and thinking about, and why is that? And so Palmer is constantly kind of tweaking his readers and saying, why do you think this is or isn't a flying saucer, you know, and what can we say about it? So I see him as challenging his readers, and in some ways being on a, you know, quest. He was not a university educated person. He was very much a working class guy who loved to bowl and things like that. So he liked to, you know, say this is his he loved getting letters from readers and having that dialogue. And so And you could see him as a collector of marvels, a kind of a guy who, these will make you think. They may be real, they may be false. So I found him a fascinating character in that sense.
Always willing to put things out there and say, you consider him. I mean, what do you think happened here? Sure. But the other thing about Ray is that, you just mentioned part of it. I mean, the fact that he could bowl, even though he was 4 feet eight and hunched over.
Right.
But he also set his mind on his own health. Because you mentioned earlier he was in a sanatorium at age 20 and about to die, it would appear.
Right.
But basically visualized his own recovery.
Yeah, I mean,
and walked out of the place.
Yes, he did, and I think no one expected it. You know, he was publishing a whole series of journals in his later years. We should say, after the science fiction market really crumbled about 1950, and he got into the Fate magazine, then sold that off to his partner and started another one called Mystic, then another one called Search, then another one called Forum. And he also had his own science fiction magazine, which he called Otherworld Science Stories, which got a lot of popular people, really, other science fiction readers really admired that one, but it didn't last. You know, and he turned it to Flying Saucers from Other Worlds and Flying Saucers magazine. But you can see him, just never giving up and deciding to move to Wisconsin just because he'd rather live in Wisconsin than a big city. He didn't want to get involved with some of the new girly magazines that were making huge profits. He didn't want to move to New York with Amazing Stories. So he moves to a 120-acre farm up in Wisconsin and just starts a little mini publishing, you know, mom-pop kind of publishing enterprise up there.
With the wife that, again, he had his heart set on from pretty early on and visualized the success there as well and got to it.
Yeah, so I think I get the sense that he was not entirely a con man. I do sense that he was in some sense, a mystic of sorts who believed in the sort of positive thinking and visualizations and loved investigating and asking, maybe this is true, maybe, you know. And so he was offering it to readers, and I think offering a refuge for people who felt like their ideas were sort of not mainstream exactly in the 1950s, Eisenhower in America, you know, to be talking about ESP or whatever. So he kind of offered a service to people, a new community in a sense.
And it is really good to step back and realize that that before Ray Palmer's time, not much of what we know now in science fiction, you know, we're talking space stories and even costume superheroes in the comic books, et cetera, not much of that existed before Ray Palmer's time.
Yeah, I mean, the comic books certainly didn't exist. The pulp magazines really kind of began that notion of kind of a superhero type people like John Carter, Edgar Rice Burroughs' character on Mars, you know, who...
With the movie that was made a couple of years ago that flopped miserably for Disney, yeah.
But I think they really it was an entirely new genre, and I think, you know, today you still see how it's making people grapple with, you know, what possible futures I would add though that Palmer, I mentioned I see him as both inspiring figure and sort of cautionary because. He also got very involved in what might be called conspiracy culture now, and I think that really begins with his interest in Shaver, and both promoting Shaver and his kind of worldview of these demons really underground, and trying to sucker, if you will, his readers into believing it too, but getting suckered himself in a sense, and starting to think, you know, this makes as much sense as any other worldview. So he had this kind of relativity kind of idea of ideas and always saying, well, his answer always was, well, I'm not saying I believe it, I'm just saying it could be true. But you see him getting involved in kind of dangerous conspiracy thinking about, for example, at the end of World War II, he was writing about how we needed, you know, one nation, one world government, and how, you know, kind of a utopian idea of, you know, we got to put an end to wars, and that's the only way to do it. But in the 1950s, he was kind of more like in the camp of the John Birch Society, thought there's this great conspiracy to take over the world, and, you know, certain groups were involved in it, and he was kind of making hints like this too. So he his legacy is not all cheerful. But on the other hand, I see it as important because he loved this idea of fusing the conspiracy notion with entertainment. Is it a pulp story or is it true? And I think we see that so much.
Well, it is interesting that he moved basically from you know, mainstream sorts of. Science fiction things often do what I think you could characterize as the tinfoil hat types. And I can see almost a direct line between, for example, Ray Palmer's work and the Art Bell show, for example.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, he would appear on some of those shows. And I would say the difference, often Palmer was so good-humored and refused to really commit himself to any of these positions. He just sort of throw them out there. So, but I see it this kind of irony, which... you could call it being a confidence man, but also I think it's sort of the aesthetic behind, you know, shows like The X-Files or Twin Peaks back in the 80s or 90s, and a lot of the current interest in the paranormal. It's kind of, it's both tongue-in-cheek and serious, but it shows a sort of a crisis in the ideas of how we really view the world. But something that Gernsback believed in back in the 20s isn't holding for everybody anymore. It's this very positivistic, scientific, you know, worldview. So He's an interesting character in that way as well.
Well, so much mixed up in that time. I mean, you know, we got World War II and its aftermath. We got the flying saucer craze. We got the fear of communism. And, of course, people certainly place a lot of the fear of invasion from other worlds on the fear of communism at the time. Was that a connection that, that Ray made very directly or something he even discussed in his work?
Well, he, you know, not surprisingly, during World War II, he was very jingoistic and rooting, you know, American troops and saying some rather unpleasant things about the Japanese and so on. I would say that, he got accused of being a communist. He was denounced to the FBI several times, and some letter writer finally sent the letter, same letter that she had sent to J. Edgar Hoover, to him, and, you know, he's just infuriated by it because he saw himself as a super patriot. And on the other hand, he said, you know, communism isn't necessarily bad. It could be good. It's just not for, it's not for me, and it doesn't seem like it's for our country. So he was willing to empathize with other systems, and he didn't have a simplistic, he wasn't a anti-communist in that sense. He was, just because he believed so much in free enterprise and individualism, but he didn't want to, you know, vilify or demonize, you know, other groups, I guess you could say.
Did he ever express any regrets about where he took his work and his readers?
Well, you definitely see a dwindling of his audience keeps getting smaller year after year. On the other hand, that was happening to a lot of the pulp science fiction writers. They really couldn't make the transition when the pulp magazines crumbled to the paperbacks and that sort of thing. So he says sometimes that he's kind of a bitter fellow, but he's also proud of his accomplishments. And I think he loved the fact that he allowed this free speculation, and he felt like he wouldn't choose another life. For example, his friend William Hamling, who started Rogue magazine, one of the first Playboy-like magazines, was, you know, a very wealthy man, and kept inviting Palmer to join him, and he just said, you know, I'd rather be on my farm up here in Wisconsin. I'm really not interested in that world. Not because he was a prude, but just because he'd rather chat with his 2,500 readers in his weekly, you know, forum magazine and that sort of thing.
All right. You know, when I first saw the name Ray Palmer, I knew it rang a bell, certainly in the mind of somebody like myself who read a lot of DC comics growing up. And sure enough, he did, in his travels, meet up with people like Mort Weisinger and Julius Schwartz, both of whom were major editors at DC Comics for a while. So,
right.
So no particular accident that the character ended up with his alter ego name, Ray Palmer.
Right. Yeah, they were revamping all their earlier superheroes at DC, and we got to the Atom, and Schwartz thought it'd be kind of funny to rename him Ray Palmer for his alter ego, and called up Palmer and said, you know, you mind if I do this? And apparently got Palmer's blessing. And for a while, it seemed like the character had some aspects of tribute to Palmer, you know, the fact that he was diminutive but powerful. There were certain paranormal kinds of qualities in some of the early episodes where he meets a guy named, I think, Mr. Odd or something like that, who says he can create earthquakes through mental power and things like that. So I think they had a little bit of fun with it. But he tried to... He really wanted to forge his own legacy, and he attempted to write a biography, which he was going to call The Martian Diaries, and he sent out his subscription ideas to everyone, and he wanted to make this grand book on paper that would last forever and beautiful illustrations, and just got very little response, and he really, I think this was kind of a crushing point for him in his career, and he ended up instead of co-publishing it with one of Richard Shaver's last works, which Shaver had since got into splitting open rocks and seeing images in them that he was painting into these really lurid canvases, like the ape bats of Mars or whatever. And so he sort of shared his final legacy. They were kind of twinned together again, and they were friends. They lived together on neighboring farms in Wisconsin. So it's a pretty profound relationship, actually.
What is the general regard from some of the contemporaries of Ray Palmer for him, people who were big names in science fiction, like Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov, for example?
You know, I think it's really mixed. I think most dismiss him. Some see him as a nuisance. Everybody sees him as important for his development of fan culture. Some people, you know, had... gave him tributes when he died as being, you know, having a real kind of genius of his own. So, you know, it was mixed. And I think the people who are more drawn to the paranormal side of things appreciated, you know, his efforts to some extent.
But things certainly did take a turn with science fiction about the time that Ray made the turn, too. The question is whether he led it or whether he followed it. But, I mean, monster movies became so popular in the 50s as sort of the other darker, more occultic edge of science fiction.
Right. But, yeah, I also see in those movies there was a sort of utopian vision of how, you know, almost a religious idea of these space brothers, for example, the movie today, The Earth Stood Still, where we have Klaatu, this kind of Jesus-like figure coming from a starship and warning Earth, a bit sternly, but in a loving sermon. So and I think in the 50s, that was more the mood, whereas these contacty tales become much more paranoid and more of an invasion scenario in the 70s and 80s, but in that era, I think there's a real utopian idea of how, you know, space travel and meeting extraterrestrials was going to be almost like a religious epiphany of sorts.
Well, certainly a lot of the fingerprints of Ray Palmer on today's science fiction in the world. The book is called The Man from Mars, Ray Palmer's Amazing Pulp Journey, now out in paperback. Fred Natus, the author, our guest today on Exchange. Fred, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
All right, take care.